All right, we're underway with the recorder, so let's do a little bit of review here. We've been talking about the most important piece of furniture in the tabernacle, a piece of furniture that began life as a very common, ordinary wooden box. No, I had one just like that. It yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a U.S. Army. This is a standard, at least when I was in the Army, I had one of these, and everyone else did. This is a standard U.S. Army footlocker. That's all this is. Okay. So anyway, this thing began life as just a wooden box, something very common and very ordinary. But it would become something extraordinary and uncommon. And I ran across this verse as I was just reading my own personal reading last week, 1 Chronicles 28:2, which brought this out very clearly. I thought, oh, glad to run across this verse. Then King David rose to his feet and said, "Listen to me, my brethren and my people. I had intended to build a permanent home for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God. So I made preparations to build it." Now, the NASB rendering here is not the greatest because Ark of the Covenant here and footstool of our God are parallel statements. So here, David describes the Ark of the Covenant as the footstool. He was understanding that he was going to build a permanent home, or he wanted to build a permanent home for God's footstool, so to speak. And so the plain old wooden box gets covered with gold, and it becomes unusual and extraordinary because it is being used in the service of the king. It becomes the Ark of the Covenant. And I brought out the fact that that's true in our lives. We all begin life as just ordinary footlockers, right? And 1 Corinthians 1:26 through 31 brought that out. We are not considered wise by the world. We're not mighty. We're not noble. In fact, the world considers us foolish and weak and base and basically despised because we believe in a God who loves and a God who heals and a God who is going to judge unrighteousness. We are the things that are not. We are simply poor little old common ordinary footlockers. But when we believe in Yeshua, we get indwelt by the Holy Spirit and he gold plates us, right? And this is what he gold plates us with. We come into Christ Jesus, we become part of Yeshua, and we get the gold plating of wisdom from God. We get the gold plating of the righteousness of Christ. We get the gold plating of sanctification where he's helping us to mature and become all he wants us to be. And we get the gold plating of redemption. We've been redeemed, bought back out of the marketplace of sin. So these are the things that count with God. And our common lives can become uncommon and unusual if we use them in the service of the king. Remember, the Ark of the Covenant, every one of these drawings, the base for this very important piece of furniture in the tabernacle was a plain wooden box. Okay, I promised you last week that we would answer a question. Where is the Ark today? Everybody asked that. Well, to dramatize the Ask Bonnie, where's the Ark today? Of course. How did you know? All right. To dramatize the answer, I went to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia has 10 locations for the Ark. For example, first one that's possible is Mount Nebo. 2 Maccabees 2, 4 through 10. Contains a reference to a document saying that the prophet Jeremiah, being warned by God before the Babylonian invasion, took the ark, the tabernacle, the altar of incense, and buried them in a cave on Mount Nebo. That's in southern Jordan today, referenced in Deuteronomy 34:1, informing those of his followers who wished to find the place that it should remain unknown until the time that God should gather his people again together and receive them unto mercy. Is there any evidence for this claim by 2 Maccabees that the ark is in Mount Nebo. Nah, nada. No evidence to back up that claim. The most common position is that the Ark of the Covenant is in the temple on the Temple Mount of Jerusalem. According to Hebrew traditions, and this would be rabbinic traditions, King Solomon, when building the temple, had the Ark of the Covenant put on a platform which could be lowered down into a tunnel system if the temple were ever overrun. Such overrun did eventually come when King Nebuchadnezzar's troops destroyed the temple and carried off its treasures. But no mention of the Ark of the Covenant was made, possibly because it had been lowered into the cave system below and secretly carried away by Levite priests. Now, there are rabbis that swear up and down on 15 Bibles that the Ark of the Covenant is there under the Temple Mount. Have they ever been able to produce evidence for it? No. So far, zero. We're hitting zero. Ethiopian Orthodox Church. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church claims to possess the Ark of the Covenant, or Tabo, in Aksum. That's the city. The object is now kept under guard in a treasury near the Church of Our Lady of Zion. That's Our Lady of Zion right here. And used occasionally in ritual processions. Well, the priest in charge of Our Lady Mary of Zion recently said that he was going to produce the Ark of the Covenant, and the very next day he reneged on his promise. Do we have any evidence that it's there? Nope, still bat zero, three strikes. Southern Africa. The Lemba people of South Africa and Zimbabwe have claimed that their ancestors carried the Ark south, calling it the Ngoma Lugundu, or the Voice of God, eventually hiding it in a deep cave in the Dumge Mountains, their spiritual home. Any evidence for that? No. Still batting zero. Michael Sanders claims that it's in the Negev, in southern Israel. Michael Sanders claims to have found the location of the Ark of the Covenant stones in Daharya, near an ancient temple created by Ramses III, now an old tower in ruins. Any evidence for that? Nah, nope. Still batting zero. Oh, man, anyone have good command of French? My French is so old. Legudo, I believe that is. Legudo, France. Several legends hold that the Ark was carried home to Legudo by Knights Templar returning from the Crusades. Any evidence for that? No. The United Kingdom. In 2003, historical author Graham Phillips traced the route of the Ark through research using biblical text as being taken to Mount Sinai in the Valley of Edom by the Maccabees, along with other religious treasures. Phillips claims that it remained there until the 1180s, when Ralph D. Sudeli, the leader of the Templars, who apparently found the Maccabean treasure at Jebel al-Madba, returned home to his estate at Herdwick. Yes, Herdwick in Warwickshire, UK, taking the treasure with him. Any evidence for that? No. No. Ireland. This is really wild, you guys. During the turn of the 20th century, British Israelites. Now, I'm not going to get into British Israelism if you're not familiar with it, so that's the subject of another different story. During the turn of the 20th century, British Israelites carried out some excavations of the Hill of Tara in Ireland looking for the Ark of the Covenant. The Royal Society of Antiquaries of Ireland campaigned successfully to have them stop before they destroyed the hill. So obviously they found nothing there. Shikoku, Japan. Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Local claims exist that the Ark is hidden within limestone caves under Mount Tsurugi. Yeah, Tsurugi. That mountain is the highest one in Shikoku, and the second highest in western Japan at 1,955 meters, 6,413 feet, and has a sacred status in the Shugendu faith, which incorporates elements of Shintoism and Buddhism. And how in the Ark of the Covenant got into that, I don't know. The Japanese government barred excavations on the mountain for environmental reasons, so there's no proof of that either. San Pete County, Utah. You know where this is going. Local legends in San Pedro County, Utah, speak of buried treasures within the earth. One particular belief is that the Ark of the Covenant is presently situated within the San Pedro Valley and is protected by the three Nephites. In following the Ark of the Covenant, Ross Carey Boren presents his thesis that the Ark was brought to the Americas by pre-Columbian Jewish immigrants described in the Book of Mormon, and that it was subsequently buried in a hill in the present-day area of San Pedro Valley. Evidence? No. There it is, the most authoritative source that we have. This authoritative source that we have. In Washington, D.C., Army intelligence agents tell Indiana Jones that the Ark is somewhere very safe to be studied by top men. In reality, the Ark is sealed in a wooden crate labeled top secret and stored in an innocuous and giant government warehouse filled with innocuous and identical and countless similar crates. My point? Don't pay attention to these Ark stories, okay, you guys? Don't pay attention to these Ark stories. They're all over the place. And I'm going to make another handout here dealing with this whole issue done by Dr. David R. Regan, Lamb and Lion Ministries. Ark of the Covenant, has it been found? So this is just something you take with you and refer to when somebody comes up with just this new theory on where the Ark of the Covenant is. Oh, I'll tell you where it is. The Ark of the Covenant was probably destroyed by the Babylonians. The Ark of the Covenant was probably destroyed around 586, maybe even earlier, by the Babylonians when they destroyed the temple. If it's found, hey, that'll be great. It's in Iran.
It's in Iraq.
If it's found, hey, that'll be great. You guys need? Okay, they're coming. Jay? Jay? Oh, here you go. Whoops, excuse me. Well, if it exists, you're exactly right. Okay, you guys got everything? Here, you need two here? There we go. And three. Okay, I've got two here. We've got some other extras. You guys are high. How many do you have? Just one? Everybody have one? One more here. I've got two more. I got two left. All right, going, gone. The two extras are up here in the notebook. All righty. So, nobody knows where the Ark of the Covenant is. Question. It's death. That's the death penalty.
So my position is that irrespective of any of these other considerations, if it was touched by anybody other than a Levite at any other time, because that mandate was never taken away, those people would have died. So I don't believe it was ever carried away.
Well, we have evidence that it was carried by the Canaanites. Remember when it was taken into captivity by the... No, the curse came upon their cities, but they were able to carry it all around and move it into the cart and all that. So as long as a Levite, I guess, doesn't actually touch the Ark itself,
right.
it apparently is okay if you are on the stage. But Uzziah, yeah, he touched the Ark itself. Right, yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, well, it's probably been destroyed by the Babylonians.
Oh,
yes.
But they would have been cursed.
No, they can burn it down.
Oh,
goodbye. Go ahead. The Ark of the Covenant? No, nobody knows where it is or even if it exists today. Well, because of all those stories that float around. There's all these videos and DVDs and stories that I have found the Ark of the Covenant, and it's here, and it's here, and it's here. If it is found, it would be a great archaeological find. I have no objection to that. But there's at least 10 stories of where, and everybody claims, I know where it is. And there's no evidence. Well, the Ark of the Covenant was... Well, yeah. Well, it could have been destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 when the temple was burned down. The Babylonians destroyed the temple, and it could very well have been destroyed there. God took his protection away from the temple and all everything considered associated with the temple in 586, and he allowed the Babylonians to destroy it. That's probably what happened.
It was shocking to think that they didn't have time to do
something. Well, we'll see. If it's somewhere and it's found, hey, I'll rejoice. But don't get caught up in all these stories. All right, let's move on. Let's move on, okay? Page 30 in your outline. Page 30 in your outline. We now come to the table of showbread. And the description of the table, point one, in chapter 25, verses 23 through 27. And we'll start with verse 23. All right, now there's the table of showbread according to the rabbis. And let's take a look at the Archkol Tanakh translation, verse 23. You shall make a table of shittim wood, 2 amos its length, 1 amah its width, and 1.5 amah its height. So, you know, what do we have here, you guys? What do we have here? We have a very common, ordinary coffee table, right? Common, ordinary coffee table, just like you would see in your living room. What's going to happen to this coffee table? Very common, ordinary thing is going to be uncommon and extraordinary. So let's see, what do we got here as far as the sides here? Is that animation? This is just a view of this coffee table. That's all it is. Something very simple. All right, point one. The dimensions of the coffee table are laid out there, 3 feet long, 1.5 feet wide, 2 feet high. But now, point two. Beside point two, put in verse 24. I forgot to put that verse in there. I wanted to cover it piece by piece. So, point two in verse 24, we find out that this common ordinary coffee table is now going to become uncommon and extraordinary. Verse 24, you shall cover it with pure gold. You shall make for it a golden diadem all around. And so, here's some animation depicting the fact that the wood now is going to be overlaid with gold leaf or gold plating or something, turning it into something very common, ordinary coffee table. Now, the rabbis provide an alternate opinion of the, or another image here. This is a close-up of the golden diadem, as it's translated here in the Archkol Tanakh version. All righty. So now it's point three, a worthy gift for a king. It's the best that Israel has to offer. It is useful for the king's service. Number four, parentheses four, add verse 25 by parentheses four. However you want to do it, indicate that parentheses four is explained in verse 25. All right, let's move on to verse 25 here then. Verse 25. You shall make for it a frame of 1 tefach all around, and you shall make a golden diadem for its frame all around. So here is our coffee table with, now, in this view, the frame is in this area, and the crown, or the zer, is along the edge. Here's an alternate opinion. You know, you get two Jews together, you get three opinions, right? So here's an alternate opinion of the way the table of showbread may have looked. Let's go back to image one, and let's do a little bit of the animation here. Here is a critical of the... this? Okay. All righty. Now, point 4A. Now, we're not sure how this frame and molding looked. Point A, it's either an outer or inner molding. The outer one was around the outside edge of the table, and the inner one being a raised lip around the showbread itself. Or two, it was a primary lip or ring between the legs of the table to strengthen the legs. So we really don't know what it looked like. As we move on to point two, the accessories for the table of showbread, we come to verses 26 through 29. And point A. Point A, we learn that the table will be portable, just like the Ark of the Covenant was. And in verses 26 through 28, the rings and poles used to transport the... You shall make for it four rings of gold and place the rings upon the four corners of its four legs. So here's a little bit of animation depicting the transportation rings being hammered into the table itself. So we have rings on the edge of the table. Verse 27. The ring shall be opposite the frame for housing for staves, the table. So here's a close-up of those rings where the carrying staves would go. Now, the alternate opinion is very minute in difference. Here the rings are at the edge of the table, and here they're centered on the legs itself. So sometimes very, very detail-oriented here. So that's hardly really worth noting, in my opinion. Verse 28. You shall have staves of shittim wood, the same as acacia wood. Shittim is the actual Hebrew term. Make the staves of shittim, cover them with gold, and the table shall be carried. We have some common acacia staves, but again, these common, ordinary staves are going to become uncommon and extraordinary because they're covered with gold, making them fit, useful service. This animation showing us how the leaf covering over the staves. Okay? All right. So, point A, the table is portable. Point B, point 2B in the middle of the page, other various utensils of the highest quality are commanded to be constructed in verse 29. So let's move on to verse 29, the Art Scroll translation. You shall make its dishes and its spoons and its tubes and its supports, with which it shall be covered of pure gold, shall you make them. So here again we have the rabbinical opinion of the accessories that went with the table. Here is what they consider the spoon and the dish to hold the bread. And then they see the, in the Hebrew text, referring to tubes and supports. I don't think this is really a valid way to view those Hebrew terms. This is the way the rabbis see it. And then we have an alternate opinion on how the tubes and supports looked, the supports being very big, heavy-duty bars and beams here with some tubes going across. So that's a rabbinic view of the accessories for the table of showbread. There's our coffee table. This is the actual table of showbread that the Temple Institute has constructed. If you go with us in November to Israel, we will go to the Temple Institute, and not only will you see this, but you'll see the clothes and the other articles that you often see in pictures up here. You'll see them in their display cases. And they're not in those display cases for historical reasons or for to be viewed as a museum. They're there in storage ready to be used for the Third Temple. They expect these implements to be used in the Third Temple. So there is the table of showbread that they have constructed for use in the Third Temple. Yeah, that's interesting. This version doesn't look like any of the other versions. It's unique here, and there's no rings on it. Yeah, so I don't know what they're planning to do there. So anyway, we'll see what happens. Now, this picture is probably a more realistic view of what we're talking about. We have this small table with the rings and the staves going through the rings. That's probably a realistic view rather than the rabbinic view. But I show you the rabbinic view because when the third temple goes up, if we happen to see that, we'll see the rabbinic opinion. We'll see the table built according to the rabbinic opinion and going in the third temple. All righty. Point three, toward the bottom of the page, the purpose for this little table is brought out in verse 30. The purpose for the table. And let's move on to verse 30 of the... On the table you shall place the bread of surfaces before me always. Notice they call this bread the bread of surfaces. Your translation probably calls it the bread of the presence, right? All right, we'll talk about that in a little bit. So here's some animation, rabbinic view of the bread of the surfaces. Ladies, would that be an easy loaf of bread to bake? And there we see the bread going on to the table of showbread and then supported by all the tubes and bars. Now, the reason the rabbis designed the bread this way is because they felt that God was telling them to make bread that had surfaces facing each other. So that means you have to make this bread in a C shape, so you've got two faces, two surfaces looking at each other. So you see the C shape, and you see the two surfaces looking at each other. However, that's a pretty wild interpretation as far as I'm concerned. This is supposed to be unleavened bread, you guys. A lot of crust. Yeah, I agree with you, Roger. I have a lot of crust. All righty. So that's a look at the bread of the surfaces that's going to go on there. Whoops, I went a little bit too fast there. Well, I've got 1 minute into your break. So let's go ahead and take our break, and we'll continue to explore this, the bread of the presence and the table of showbread after the break. All right, we're underway again. Okay, well, be sure and get it after class then. Okay, or do you guys... I'll send it back to you here. Oh, pass it back. Okay. All righty. We're at point three, the purpose for the table. And we saw in verse 30 that it's the purpose is to hold the bread of the presence or the bread of the faces as the art scroll version rendered it. But a better rendering would be the bread of the presence. And that term presence refers to the presence of God. Question? We'll get to the recipe in just a moment. Okay. Now, the literal Hebrew, point C, is in the plural. The literal Hebrew is the word faces. And it implies face-to-face with God. That's the idea, not the... Not that the bread has to have two faces looking at each other. The idea here is that we'd be face to face with God. And so point D is that rabbinic interpretation that I told you about. They felt the bread had to be baked with the two faces looking at each other, facing each other. But again, this is probably a better rendering of that table. And again, here's the rabbi, here's another rendering here, and now we get an idea of what this table might look like by comparing what we found on the Arch of Titus in Rome. The Arch of Titus in Rome has a relief on the inside showing the artifacts from the temple being paraded in Rome. And one of the artifacts that comes into view on the Arch of Titus is the storage table for the silver trumpets right here. So the rabbis have examined that, and they have built a trumpet storage table for the silver trumpets to be used during the time of the Third Temple. So this table is probably more realistically a more realistic view of what the table of showbread actually looked like. Just imagine that covered with gold, and you probably have a better view of what's going on than this rendition of the table of showbread. Yeah, that's a bit contrived, I would say, yes. All righty, let's see. I've got some handouts for you. Not yet, though. All righty, let's go to page 31. And we come to the recipe for the bread. Yes. Yeah. We'll get into that. We'll get into that. I'm getting there, okay? All right, page 31. The bread itself is described in Leviticus 24, verses 5 and 6. And here it is. Then you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each cake. You shall set them on 2 rows, 6 to a row, on the pure gold table before the Lord. You shall put pure frankincense on each row, that it may be a memorial portion for the bread, even an offering by fire to the Lord. Every Sabbath day he shall set it in order before the Lord continually. It is an everlasting covenant for the sons of Israel. It shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place. For it is most holy to him from the Lord's offering by fire, his portion forever. So here are the 12 loaves that are baked. They're unleavened bread. There's no leaven indicated in the description of the loaves. Point 1A, they are a perpetual offering to the Lord. In other words, they are going to be offered as long as the Mosaic covenant is in existence. Point B, they're placed on the table each Sabbath and left there until the following Sabbath. 7 days, and then when the loaves are removed, they're eaten by the priests. So they're probably arranged in 2 rows or 2 columns, 2 stacks of 6 loaves each, as we have seen in general here. Point E, frankincense table and burned either in small piles or in small bowls alongside the loaves. And here are the here is the table of showbread with 2 stacks of the unleavened. Some kind of frankincense censers were placed. These are the ones made by the Temple Institute. A small coal from the altar would probably be placed in this censer, and then the frankincense poured upon it. And so this is a memorial offering. A memorial offering is a reminder, something to always bring to our memory. So it's a memorial offering. A memorial offering. And that brings us to point 4 in your outline in the middle of the page, the significance of the table of showbread. And we begin with the historical significance. And historically, there were 3 messages communicated by the table and the items that the table held. Point 1, the first message was that of physical nourishment. See, bread was the mainstay of the ancient diet. That was a key article in the ancient diet. And so it became symbolic of mankind's need of food, mankind's need of nourishment of all kinds. Point C, Yeshua used bread as a symbol of nourishment in Matthew 6:11, the Lord's Prayer. You're all probably very familiar with that. He says, give us this day our daily bread. Where he's not in in teaching us to pray that way, he wasn't asking us to pray only for sourdough French. You know, only provide sourdough French for me, God. What we're asking here is for God to provide all our daily needs. And bread is a symbol of all our daily nourishment. So it's a reminder that God provides daily physical sustenance. Daily physical sustenance. So at this point, I want to give you another handout. I have two dictionary articles here for you. The one side of the sheet contains an article on the showbread, just to supplement your notes. And the other side of the sheet contains an article about bread in general, because bread is the mainstay of mankind's diet. And so that is explained on the other side. I think if you read that article, you'll get quite a different view of bread and nourishment and all those common everyday things we take so much for granted. Just grab one. Yeah, there we go. Okay. All righty. You guys need two. Okay. All righty. Very good. And you guys need two. And any extras here? One extra here. How about the back? All right, I've got three left over. Everybody got one? Didn't I give you one? Okay. All right, two extras to be put into the notebook up to the front. All righty, let's move on to page 32. And the second important concept communicated by the table and the bread upon the table, and that concept is communion and fellowship. In the ancient Near East, point A, eating with another meant friendship and acceptance. Point B, the table and the bread emphasized the idea of meeting someone face to face over a meal. You know, when you go out with somebody to have lunch with them or dinner, you don't sit back to back, do you? You sit face to face. That's the idea. That you're, point C, you're involved in personal and intimate relationship with that person when you eat with them. I think we're losing a lot of that in modern America, where everybody sits in front of the TV and watches the video, you know. Point D, in ancient Israel, hospitality was a highly esteemed virtue. The guest was sacred. It was an honor to provide for a guest. And so, the bread is a reminder of Israel's face-to-face communion or fellowship with God. And it just emphasizes how God desires our fellowship. And that's carried over into the New Testament as well. You know, Revelation 3:20. Now, some hold that this is an evangelistic verse. Others hold that is a fellowship verse. But either way, the idea is the same. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and what? Dine with him and he with me. Now, why did Yeshua use that picture? Because eating with another person was a much more important event than in 21st century America. You know, we just have casual business lunches or, you know, you never see that person again. That wasn't the idea in the first century. You took it very, very seriously. And because of the serious nature of hospitality and eating with people, I've got two more handouts for you. Both of these handouts, each handout is a dictionary article on the idea of hospitality. And it's going to be very different than you as a 21st century Southern California are probably used to. But I do want you to read both articles. Each author has a little different emphasis in each article, but put them together and you get a pretty good, well-rounded view of what hospitality meant in the ancient Near East. And I really think that the view of hospitality in the ancient Near East is more common in other areas of the world than here. here in the United States, we're, especially in Orange County, California, we are this rushabout, informal, shallow culture. Okay? Everybody got one? And did you need another? Oh, you need two each time? I'm sorry. Okay, two extra copies up front. Okay, here's your second article on hospitality. So here you go. Again, a little bit different emphasis by a different author, but well worth looking at, comparing, considering seriously. Oh, here's the second article on hospitality, a different Bible dictionary. These articles are from two different Bible dictionaries. Okay, you're all right? Did you get them? Did you get the second one? Okay, there we go. All right, how about here? All right, we need one here. Let me get to the back. There's an extra here. And we have some extras here. Okay, who didn't get one? We need two here. Three. All right, and Bonnie? Okay, I've got two left. All righty. Everybody got one? All right, that's your second article on hospitality. Read those tonight before you go to bed. All righty. All right, we're now in the middle of page 32. Point three. The third important concept communicated by the table is communicated by the frankincense. The frankincense, the incense on the table symbolizes prayer. It's a reminder that Israel experiences fellowship with God through Psalm 141, verses 1 and 2. This is one of my favorite verses of Scripture. A psalm of David. O Lord, I call upon you. Hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. May my prayer be counted as incense before you. Parallel concepts. The lifting up of my hands, prayer, as the evening offering, incense. So here's an example. Here's a picture of the high priest offering the incense in the temple. He's standing before the altar of incense, which we'll talk about toward the end of the class. He's pouring the powdered incense upon the coals, and then the fragrant smoke is rising up to fill the holy place. Now, he couldn't go into the Holy of Holies except once a year. No one else could go into the Holy of Holies. But what would the fragrant smoke do? The fragrant smoke would penetrate through the veil into the Holy of Holies, right? And that's a picture of our prayers. You know, we can't get into the spiritual realm in these bodies. These bodies are not designed to go there, right? We can't go there. But our prayers can penetrate the physical spiritual barrier and go into the presence of God. So the next time you pray, I want you to view your prayers like this smoke going up, going where you can't go. And again, very pleasant to God. Very present, because this was fragrant incense. And in Psalm 141, David just describes one of the postures of prayer that Scripture describes. There is no set posture of prayer. But in Psalm 141, David is standing here praying with his arms raised. Very valid posture of prayer spoken of in Psalm 141. All righty. I like that picture. That's one of my favorite pictures, too. All right, summary, point four. The table and the bread of the presence were a memorial offering, a reminder that God sustains his people and desires their communion and prayer. Point B. Now we move to the messianic significance of the table and the showbread. And we begin in point one by sharing a little bit of rabbinic confusion with you. This is really amazing and really kind of sad. This comes from the Hertz Pentateuch, which is a Jewish study Bible that's been around for quite a while. And Rabbi Hertz writes on page 329, The symbolic meaning of the showbread is a matter of conjecture. Maimonides confesses, I do not know the object of the table with the bread upon it continually, and up to this day, I have not been able to assign any reason to this commandment. All right, now who's Maimonides? For you guys who don't know, you can look him up on Wikipedia if you want. Moses Maimonides, also known as the Rambam. That's an acronym for his name, Rabbi Moses ben Maimon. Make sense? Okay, Rabbi Moses ben Maimon. The Rambam. The rabbis say often from Moses, meaning ancient Moses, the first Moses, to Moses. They see him as a second Moses. All right, Moses Maimonides, also known as the Rambam, was the preeminent medieval Jewish philosopher and one of the greatest Torah sages of the Middle Ages, acknowledged to be one of the foremost rabbinical arbiters and philosophers in Jewish history. And there's a well-known statue erected to him in Cordova, Spain. All right, a top rabbi in our history. He looks at this verse, these verses dealing with the showbread, and he goes, I don't know. I haven't been able to figure it out. I don't know what this means. Well, he should come to this class. We have an answer. Page 33. Page 33. Page 33. I'm not going to answer that one, Raj. All right, our answer, top page 33, number 2. Yeshua is the bread of life. We turn our attention to Yeshua in John 6:35, and Yeshua said, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will not hunger. He who believes in me will never thirst. Point 2a. Just as bread symbolized provision of daily physical needs, so Yeshua, as the bread of life, is the provision for daily spiritual needs. He sustains us daily, and he desires our fellowship through prayer. And I'm going to bring up Revelation 3:20 again, but I'm going to make a little different emphasis as I read it, a personal emphasis. Behold, I, Yeshua, he's the one who's speaking. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him, and he with me. I just want to emphasize the personal relationship that God wants with all of us. He wants to dine with us, so to speak. He wants to be part of the very fabric, the warp and woof of our lives. He wants to be face to face with us continually. And that is not only a great privilege, it's a great comfort. We see here the love of God just in these statements. Okay? Question? Oh, because he lived in Spain in medieval times, under Muslim domination, actually. But he lived in Spain, in medieval Spain. All righty, point 3. First, Yeshua is the bread of life, but secondly, in point 3, I want to emphasize using just one example that Yeshua was a man of prayer. Many, many examples of this. I just chose Luke 6:12. It was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. Yeshua was picking his disciples here. He didn't do it in a random, casual way. He spent all night praying to the Lord. Now, I don't know how many of us have ever spent all night praying to the Lord, but I never have. I never have. So he's a great example to me of prayer. I'm not the man of prayer that he is. So point 4. Yeshua is depicted by the table in the tabernacle in the bread of life, and his life is characterized by prayer. Point A, question to ask ourselves. Do we set adequate devotions and prayer time so that we can grow in our fellowship with Yeshua? You know, we need to be face-to-face with Him constantly. So we need to set aside devotions and personal devotions and personal prayer time. And He wants that. He wants that. We'll grow in our fellowship. B. Do we seek Him often and earnestly on a moment-by-moment, day-by-day basis, or is He just our life preserver when we're in trouble? What's the characteristic of our prayers? Point C. Do we limit our prayers to one word? Help! Two words. Lord, help! Three words. Lord, please help! Now, there's a time and a place for cries for help. And we see that in the Psalms all the time, right? David cries out for help. But you know, if we don't spend time in day-to-day fellowship and prayer, when we come to those emergencies, we may not remember to cry out for help. But if we're fellowshipping with Him all the time, it's going to be instinctual when that's needed. Okay? So I hope our prayers are not limited to and characterized simply by that one word, help. Point D, what should our lives look like? Ephesians 6:18 through 19 is an example, an encouragement to us. Let's try to make our lives look like this. With all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit. And with this in view. So we're to pray without ceasing, aren't we? We're to pray on the job. We're to pray washing the dishes and mowing the lawn and running the vacuum cleaner. We're to especially pray driving on the freeway, right? Pray at all times. And you can. You can pray at your printing press. I used to run a printing press. I would pray during that printing press, you know. As long as there are final tests in school, there will be prayer in school, right? Okay? You can pray on the Temple Mount. You go with us in November, the Muslims say, no Bibles, no praying. Well, I've prayed every time I've been up there, all right? Many of us have, all right? Pray at all times. And with this in view, here's some ideas, a couple of suggestions on how to pray. Be on the alert with all perseverance. So be alert, be awake, persevere, continue, even though it seems fruitless. Be on the alert with all perseverance and petition for the saints. So that's for your brothers and sisters in general. So general prayers, but now Paul makes a specific request. And pray on my behalf. So when our brothers and sisters ask for prayer, do it. That's what Paul did here. What did he ask for prayer? He said, pray that utterance may be given to me in the opening of my mouth to make known with boldness the mystery of the gospel. So just be ready. Be ready at all times to pray for your brothers and sisters, to pray when they ask you for specific needs. Persevere. Persevere. You know, you might have to pray for somebody's salvation for 20 or 30 years. You just might. You just might. Persevere. That's a hard one for me. Persevering. Yeah, similar idea. Right. Okay. So let's make Ephesians 6, 18 and 19 the characteristic of our lives. And so we can answer that question on point E. Are we growing in our knowledge of Him? Yeah, we can. If we face to face all the time. All right, I'm going to close the class with one more handout, the last handout of the evening. And what I'm giving you are two slides. One image is the realistic view of the table of showbread and the bread, and the bottom slide is the rabbinical view. Now, the upper slide is what was probably seen in the tabernacle But the bottom slide is what you'll see if the third temple goes. Well, in fact, if you go with us to Israel, you'll see it in the you'll see that table in the Temple Institute. So I just want to alert you that the two concepts are radically different from each other. All right, let's get these slides passed out, and then I'll pray, and I'll send us on our way. Okay. Is that one or two there?
He just said he hopes some of our grandchildren's
two. Say again? Zerubbabel, yeah. Any, you guys, did you, do you need one? You got it? Okay. And what do we need here? All right, there's another one. Let me get the extras. Did everybody get one here? And, okay, everybody in the back row, second row, you guys needed how many? One. Any others? I've got three left over here. All right, these extras will be up in the notebook, up to the front. All righty, next week, we'll pick it up next week with the next item of furniture. And the next item of furniture will be the menorah. So we'll take a look at this next week. All right, let me pray and I'll send you on your way. Father, thank you for the lessons we've learned from the table of showbread, that you sustain us, provide for us, want our fellowship, want to be face to face with us. Thank you for the lesson from the frankincense, that you desire this through prayer. And we look forward to the time when we can be face to face with you as our King during the Messianic Kingdom and during the Eternal State, when we'll be face to face always and in a real sense rather than in the more distant sense that we experience today. So, Lord, help us to grasp hold of these ideas and to continually look to you throughout the day, throughout every moment of our lives, lifting up our concerns to you in prayer, whether it be a cry for help or a praise or a specific request. Help us to maintain our relationship with you on a day-to-day basis and change us through that. Make us your bright and shining lights in this world that we can tell others about our relationship with you and the hope that you give us, the hope of eternal life. We lift this up in Yeshua's name. Amen.